DNA is the major systematic force making us who we are as individuals. Environmental, experiential differences are important, but they're not these systematic effects that we used to think were important, like parenting, for example. You could go back into the 70s, even when I was in graduate school, and you could read that schizophrenia is caused by what your mother did to you in the first few years of life. And it's not unreasonable, I suppose, but you know, we now know there's no evidence for that. Whereas schizophrenia is one of the more highly heritable aspects of psychopathology. We know things run in families. Psychopathology runs in families, height, weight, everything runs in families. But for centuries, it was thought that that was due to the environment. But what we know now is that what runs in families is DNA. The environment's important, but it's not making family members similar.
Quote, DNA isn't all that matters, but it matters more than anything else. And it matters more than everything else put together in determining who we are. And I'd love to start with a basic question, which is, what does that mean? And how do we know that's true?
Right. Well, that is the message of my book, Blueprint. And the subtitle is, can you see that?
Yes, I can.
Okay. It's how DNA makes us who we are. And that is how DNA makes us who we are as individuals. So there's so much to unpack here, but let me just go straight to the bottom line, and then we can kind of fill it in as we go along. The first message is that genetics, that is inherited DNA differences, account for about half of the differences between people on almost any trait you can mention, from cognitive abilities to psychopathology, anything in psychology. So genetics it's 50% of the variance, which isn't 100%, but that's off the scale of what we can explain with what other things that we know in psychology. But the other message is even harder for people to understand, and that is that genetic studies have shown that the way the environment works is very different from the way everyone thought it worked from Freud onwards. Everyone thought it was nurture, that is, systematic effects of the family environment. But what genetic research has shown is that the environment accounts for about 50% of the differences between people, but it's not due to systematic effects of family environment. I've come to think after 30 years of looking for these environmental factors that what it's really about is randomness, probably in the sense of this, the noise from and stochastic effects of complex biological systems. And so I know that's a lot to unpack, but if that's why I would say the DNA is the major systematic force making us who we are as individuals. Environmental, experiential differences are important, but they're not these systematic effects that we used to think were important, like parenting, for example. So I know that last part is especially hard for people to believe, but it really is, you know, incontrovertible now that, you know, we're used to blaming our parents for everything, but you can pin the genetics on them, but you really can't pin the environment on them very much.
Hmm. I heard you in prior, as I was preparing for this conversation, I heard you use the word stochastic. And I looked it up just to be able to have, and you correct me if I'm wrong or where you would like to correct this, but when you say stochastic, my understanding is that you mean randomly determined, that that's what stochastic means. And I want to dig into the specifics of the conclusions that you've reached over your career about the role that genes play in who we see in the world, how people end up as human beings. I also want to clarify, I think, something you just alluded to, which is everyone has heard the nature versus nurture debate. The quote I read, I think, to start this conversation is about the nature component. When we think of nurture, so as you alluded to, 50% roughly of how people end up is due to their genes. The other 50%, the nurture component, I think I had historically thought that was child rearing.
Right.
That was how people were, you know, formed in their familial communities. But really, in researching for this conversation, that isn't, I think, what you're alluding to, that there's a more of a randomness component that determines the rest of who people become. And I'd love for you to correct anything I just said or add anything to that.
I would like to add a bit to that. No, it's exactly right. And your thought that the environment is nurture, which means systematic effects of the environment, family environment, which is parenting, basically. And that was Freud's whole thing. I mean, you could go back into the 70s, even when I was in graduate school, and you could read that schizophrenia is caused by what your mother did to you in the first few years of life. And, you know, it's not unreasonable, I suppose, but, you know, we now know there's no evidence for that. Whereas schizophrenia is one of the more highly heritable aspects of psychopathology. So genetics is important, but the environment isn't that what we call shared family environment. It isn't growing up with someone, as reasonable as that is. In fact, all these methods we use, twin studies and adoption studies, the whole goal is to say, yeah, we know things run in families. Psychopathology runs in families, cognitive abilities runs in families, height, weight, everything runs in families. But for centuries, it was thought that that was due to the environment. Mm. It's due to the growing up with people, having your parents rear you. And so the methods try to separate genetic and environmental causes of family relationships, relatedness. But what we know now is that what runs in families is DNA. The environment's important, but it's not making family members similar. So one concrete example I think that helps people is weight. Now, you know, I wonder what your audience thinks causes people to differ in weight. You know, right now it's kind of a hot topic in England, especially. There's a lot of what we call fat shaming, you know, actually thinking about making people pay more for their medical health, because weight is a major factor in many diseases, you know, heart disease and diabetes and cancer even. So it's kind of assumed that it's environmental, and it's very reasonable to think, you know, that it's due to your family environment. We know siblings in a family are similar in weight, and parents and offspring are similar in weight. So parents provide the food that kids get. So it's very reasonable to think it's due to nurture. But one method that we use is the adoption method. So the problem with normal families is they share genes and environment. You can't say whether it's genes or environment. For a century, we just assumed it was the environment. But then, you know, as we became more aware of genetics, we said, well, maybe it's genetic, because family members are 50% related genetically. And so here's the thing. The correlation between parents and offspring is about when the offspring are adults, I mean, when they're kids, you know, their weight is a different thing. So it's say about 0.4. That's a correlation, goes from 0 to 1. So 0.4 is a correlation that's pretty close to 0.5, which is how similar they are genetically. Hmm. But adoption then is a social experiment in which you separate nurture parents, that is adoptive parents of kids who are adopted away at birth, and nature parents, that is birth parents, biological parents who relinquish their kid for adoption at birth. And those kids are raised in the adopted families. So I hope people can see that that's a pretty neat test of nature and nurture. And the amazing thing is, several studies have shown this. The correlation between adoptive parents' weight and their adopted children's weight is 0. No correlation at all. Even though the parents provide the food, the exercise, they model health, you know, and all of that. And what's the correlation between the birth parents and these adopted away kids that they never see? 0.4. Hmm. So it suggests that there's very substantial genetic influence. And twin methods compare identical and non-identical twins. It's a little more difficult to understand. But if you do a survey of people, as I've done, to say how heritable you think weight is, that is it all due to genetics, or is it all due to the environment, or what? And, you know, it turns out people think it's maybe some genetic influence, but they greatly underestimate how important inherited DNA differences are for weight. In fact, it's about 60%, we call it heritable, that is, differences in inherited DNA among people is responsible for more than half of the differences we see as you look around. And, you know, you can sort of, well, so it's a very major factor. But the other side of it is that, okay, it's not 100%, maybe it's 60%. But that 40% is not due to nurture. It's not due to these growing up with somebody. Whatever it is, it's making two kids in the same family no more similar than kids picked at random. So we don't know what that is, but we know it's not due to nurture.
Hmm. I know from prior interviews that you've done that you have given just an anecdote about yourself related to this. And this is another phrase I looked up in preparation for this, and you talk a lot about this as well, the polygenic scores that I think in your mind are the future of just personalized data that people get about their own individualized genomes. And I'd love it if you're comfortable sharing what you learned. This is, again, piggybacking on the idea of weight, about yourself and how you have, you know, thought through this. So much of this conversation, I want to, because I love your attitude about all of the conclusions related to genes, and that I think it's your view that this can help us be a more empathetic and compassionate and better people, a better humanity. And I'd love to maybe just zero in on that example about what you learned about your weight and your capacity for putting weight on and how you've thought about that for yourself.
Yeah. Well, that's great. It's a great segue into what I think is what I call the DNA revolution. And about being more compassionate and humane, just knowing that inherited DNA differences are so important for body weight is it, you know, it's useful for people. You know, you won't, because it's reasonable to think, well, why is this person fat? Well, you know, they don't have any self-control. I mean, just get a grip, you know, don't eat like a pig, you won't be fat. But that's easy for thin people to say. And for people actually like me, who have, I have a strong genetic propensity towards weight. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But people say, well, if you could predict your weight genetically, you'd just give up. You know, you'd say, well, can't do anything about it. And the thing I'd really like to get to is to say, it's actually helped me tremendously to know that the reason I have trouble with weight is that my polygenic score, that is a score created from thousands of DNA differences that predicts about 20% of the variance of weight, my polygenic score is my highest risk score. I'm at the 95th percentile genetically for weight. Now, I'm at the 70th percentile for actual weight. But what it's done is it doesn't make me say, oh, well, eat, drink, and be merry. I'm just going to die because I'm going to be fat and, you know, nothing I can do about it. To the contrary, and I think this is the case for most of these examples of what would you do if you knew about your risk, it actually helps you to realize you've got a lifelong battle of the bulge, and it actually motivates you to do something about it. You know, it's not just the 2 pounds, 4 pounds you gain every year and you never get rid of. It's just you, in my case, you know, there's two psychological mechanisms for weight that psychologists talk about. One is satiety. You know, you feel full. And when you're a normal person, I can't see your whole body, but I assume you're kind of normal weight. And for people of normal weight, you find if you're full, you say, oh, I'm full. And if I gave you more food, you'd say, no, I don't want that. It makes me sick. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say that too. I'm full. But then if I'm out at a restaurant with other people and there's food on the table, we're chatting away, and before you know it, I've eaten all the food, even though I said I was full. So that's satiety, is the sense of feeling full. And you're missing some genetic links for that, you know? And then the other one is responsiveness to food cues, you know? This is bad. Whenever I talk about this, I used to make bread, for example, and even imagining the smell of warm bread and how it tastes when it's still warm and you put some butter on it and it melts, you know, so I can't bake bread anymore because, you know, it's just, I could resist it, but it's just too hard. So instead, I change my environment to accommodate my this ability in the sense that I can have, if I had crisp potato chips in the house, you know, I could say, well, I'll just have one, you know, late at night, you're tired. But then you're sitting and watching a podcast or something, and before you know it, the whole bag's gone. So it's people who are skinny just don't understand that it. I would say it's not just a matter of free will. I mean, if you put a gun to my head and said, don't eat, I'm certainly not going to eat. You know, I will lose weight. But it's just that it's sort of life on the fly and lots of stuff are going on, and you're not going to dedicate your life to controlling your impulse for food. Plus, it's good. You know, there's such good food. You know, it's the problem of a Stone Age brain in, you know, food being bombarded by food cues all the time, you know, where it's not a problem of when our next meal is going to come. It's just a problem of eating too much all the time. So I think it's a good example of these polygenic scores. And let me just mention, this is what the DNA revolution is about. Up until the 1990s, when you said genetic, people were thinking about the gene. You know, like there's one gene for these things. But what we've learned, I could go into the technology of it, but there's something called a SNP chip that measures hundreds of thousands of DNA differences throughout the whole genome. That is 3 billion base pairs of DNA, 10 million of those steps in the spiral staircase of DNA differ between us on average. And so the trick then is to say, do any of those DNA differences make a difference? And instead of finding that one or a handful of those genes are responsible, say, for differences in weight, for weight and all complex disorders and traits, everything in psychology, it's thousands of little differences. It isn't just a few. And so what do you do with that? You're not going to study gene-brain behavior pathways if each gene has such a tiny effect. It's even hard to trace the effect of a gene through the brain and to behavior if it's a major mutation. But for complex traits in common disorders, we're talking about thousands of these, each with very little effects. So in the 2007, the first polygenic score was created, poly meaning multiple gene score. And it's a simple idea. It's like if you have a bunch of items on a scale, you can add them up and get a total score. And that's a better predictor than, you know, any of those individual items. Well, the same thing's here. We can add up scores for thousands of these DNA differences. And that's what we call a polygenic score. And even though any one of those predicts a minuscule amount of variance, together they can predict for weight maybe 25% of the variance, for height maybe 30, 40% of the variance. So it's these polygenic scores are really going to be the future in psychology, because they're very difficult to create. You need huge samples to create these polygenic scores to know which SNPs are related to a trait. But once that's done, and currently people are doing them with millions of people in their study, where they get like height and weight or psychopathology, and they do the DNA testing. Some of your audience might have heard of 23andMe or Ancestry.com. That's based on these, what we call SNP chips, these arrays that genotype hundreds of thousands of DNA differences. So once you get your DNA tested, genotyped, we call it, for maybe $100 or so, you can then use that to create any of hundreds of polygenic scores. And that's going to be getting to be the hot thing. And it's really happening in medicine. In the UK last year, we just started a project, not me, but a huge consortium started a project with 5 million people so that they could access the NHS records. That's a huge advantage that we have in the UK, unlike the US, where records are all state controlled or even, you know, controlled at smaller levels. But here, I joined this as well. It's called Our Future Health. And the first thing they want to know is, do you agree to allow them to have access to your NHS, National Health Service records? So that gives them a huge amount of data. And then they do your DNA testing. And the thing now, the hot thing now, is not to do a SNP chip with, say, 600,000 SNPs, but to do what we call whole genome sequencing, where you sequence all 3 billion base pairs of DNA. And that's all she wrote. That's all we inherit. So everything about genetics is in that information. And there's a lot we don't know yet about how that information, you know, how we can make sense of that information. But this is going to be a real game changer. And so whole genome sequencing is kind of the latest, biggest development that used to cost like $10,000. And now there was a prize a few years ago to get it down to 1,000. But as with all of these things, it's down to a few hundred dollars. And you just do it once, you know, and then we know your inheritance. And so you can then use that forever in the future to make predictions about your medical outcomes, as well as psychology. And it's going to happen, and it is happening in medicine first, you know, like predicting cardiovascular disease. And it's a no-brainer in medicine, because it's economically, personally, and everything. If you could predict and prevent a heart attack, that's just off the scale better than doing what we've done until recently. You wait until someone has a heart attack, and then you try to fix it. And with all of these disorders, we're not very good at that. You know, and that includes obesity, alcoholism, schizophrenia. Once you've waited until you've developed the disorder, it's really hard to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And there's so much collateral damage and everything. So it's just clear in a medical sense that what you want to do is predict and prevent heart attacks, which we can do even with low-tech solutions. And that's where I would really like to see psychology and psychopathology go, prevention rather than cure. And the best predictor in town is DNA. I mean, there's no early warning system better than DNA because, and I don't know if people often don't really appreciate this, you know, that we all start life with one cell where half of the chromosomes are from your mother, half from your father. And all the cells, trillions of cells in your body, have that same DNA. So that you could predict schizophrenia and dementia at birth just as well as you can when you're 80. And there's no other predictor that works like that. I mean, most of the time, we can't predict much at all. But whatever you can predict at birth as well as you can any other time in life. So that's an amazing difference with DNA. And that's why there is getting to be this revolution in medicine, especially.
Absolutely mind-blowing. And
it is, really.
I think I've heard you say this, that the full genome sequencing is already offered to every citizen in Estonia and Finland. And it's forthcoming, I think, for the UK. And I'd love, if I'm right about that, I'd love to give a little bit of space to what that world might look like. And as you said, that, you know, you can have that information from birth. How, to an ordinary person, how might this help them? What will this information do to hopefully improve people's lives?
Yeah. Well, as with any major advance, there's things that people worry about. And so there's lots of, I would call them doom mongers, who can talk about the dangers, starting with security of, you know, data breaches and confidentiality issues, to other sort of ethical issues. But then also issues of labeling, people worry about that. And what I get is, if I talk to a public audience and say, although dementia is caused by many genes, there's one gene that has a major effect. It's called apolipoprotein E. And if it's recessive, meaning you need two doses of it, which is the case for most genetic disorders. Otherwise, they'd be selected out if it was a major dominant mutation. So anyway, they're recessive. So if you're the unlucky soul who has two recessive alleles with that mutation, APOE4, that allele, you, instead of having the 10-15% risk of having dementia at 80, which is all our risk, we all have that risk, which is an enormous risk, it's more like 60-70%. Now, that's not 100%, but as medical risks go, that is a very big risk. So I'd ask an audience, you could do that right now. In fact, 23andMe provides that information. And there's a long history to that, and it's tricky, and there's a triple lock, but you know that information is there if you wanted it. And I ask people, would you want to know? And it almost always splits right down the middle. Half of the people say, reasonably enough, no, I wouldn't want to know it. It ruined my life. There's nothing I can do about it now. So I'd always be worrying that the first time I forget something, oh my God, this is dementia starting. But then there's the other half, like me, who says, well, knowledge is power. And you might not be able to do anything right now about it, but you'd certainly pay attention to all the studies, the medical studies now that aren't trying to treat dementia in demented people. They're trying to do things that ameliorate or at least put off the onset of dementia. And that's important because it's said that if we all lived long enough, we'd all be demented. Mm. You know, it's kind of, from an evolutionary perspective, it's kind of amazing that decades after our reproductive age, this brain, the most complicated organ in the universe, is still functioning at all. I mean, at 76, I shouldn't be able to talk, you know? And it's just really amazing. It actually does so well, you know, so much later. So we shouldn't be amazed that there are some, you know, creaks and problems. But, you know, even demented people, they're still human beings. I mean, until it gets to a very advanced state. So anyway, is there nothing you can do about it? And I say, knowledge is power. There definitely is stuff. If I knew I had that 70% risk, I would start planning now. I would try to arrange my life economically, but mostly, you know, socially as well. I'd make sure I would be taken care of in that situation. And the other thing I'd probably do is, you know, have a bigger dose of carpe diem and say, I'm not going to wait till I retire to take those trips or to do this stuff that people always say they're going to do when they retire. So I think there's a lot of examples like that, that it's useful to have this information. But I can certainly understand people who say they don't want it. I think it's like a personality difference as much as anything. You know, I bet it would spill over into a lot of other issues about anxiety and I don't know what. But and I don't want to put people down who say, oh no, I don't want to know, because you know it is understandable. But I do like the idea that knowledge is power, and there are things you can do about it. And even if there weren't, I sort of want to know. Mm. And those are the people, the 27 million people who have done DNA testing commercially. Mm. So I really think it's going to happen. And you're right about Estonia. And I've heard that about 85% of the people, the way it works is if you go into the hospital in Estonia or Finland and they take blood, they just say, would you like us to do this DNA testing? And so I heard from Estonia that 85% of the people say yes. And there, they won't give you like 23andMe information. They don't give you all your DNA information. They give you, and this is probably what they'll do in the UK, actionable information. So cardiovascular risk, no brainer. You know, and it can just be, we thought you'd like to know you've got this risk. And we all know we're supposed to eat well, exercise, you know, reduce our stress and all of that. But if you knew as if we did all the men in the UK, it's something like 10% are walking around with a hugely greater, like a 5-10-fold greater risk of having a major heart attack in midlife. Mm. If you knew you were one of those people, you'd say, well, maybe I will pay attention to that. But then you can go beyond that, you know, all the way whole body scans that can actually look at fuzzy arteries, you know, before they start getting blocked and causing heart attack. So so that's actionable information. How could you disagree? Then I have people say, well, what about alcoholism? It turns out we can't predict it so well yet, but you can make some prediction. And if you have a kid and your kid took this test, say in adolescence, and found out they were at high risk on this polygenic score, you say, A, it doesn't mean you're going to be alcoholic, but B, it means you're at least slightly greater risk than your buddies. And if you go out and get bombed, they're probably not going to get addicted, whereas you're more likely to. So no brainer. I mean, you know, just do what we're all supposed to do. Monitor your alcohol use. Take holidays from alcohol just to make sure you're not really hooked on it. And then, you know, there's other things you can do to go further than that. So I think it can be a very positive, reinforcing, helpful mechanism to deal with our problems. And it certainly does not mean that you throw up your hands and say, nothing I can do about it. It's genetic.
Hmm. Is it fair to assume that these polygenic scores, the probabilities, which again, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the probability that you are someone, for example, that is at high risk for alcoholism, for example, or obesity or weight gain, that over time, that data will improve and just the clarity around your genetic makeup and what that means for your risk profile will get inevitably better. Is that your conclusion of what the future might look like as well?
Absolutely. My book came out just at the cusp of the first wave of this research, you know, in 2018. And that's what it's all about now, bigger and better studies. It's why the UK is providing, it's something like £200 million to do this study of 5 million people to get, you know, bigger and bigger data sets, and researchers around the world collaborate. So that is definitely happening. You know, it's not happening as fast as I'd like because this is, you know, big science, and that means big money and collaboration and lots of meetings, but it's definitely happening. This isn't sky in the pie, and it's already here. It's just that you'd like it to be even better.
Hmm. Yeah. I want to clarify something, because as I was talking to people I know about having this conversation with you, and I'm sure you've gotten this throughout your career, when I would bring up points that I was learning from you in preparation for this conversation, for example, that one's propensity for obesity, one's likelihood of their weight or their intelligence being in the 50% influenced by genes, 60% influenced by genes. I think people often have a difficult time understanding what you are saying there. It isn't that it's fully genetic. That seemed to be the first leap I often would hear from people, which is that, well, it can't be all genetic. It's not 100%. And at no point have you ever said that about anything I have ever heard you articulate. But I'd love to give some space to you to just clarify the nuance around to take a step back briefly and give you some space to talk about what exactly the truth of these data sets are really revealing about probability.
Right. Well, that's exactly, I think that is exactly the issue that you run into with people. If you say, in fact, it used to be a major problem, almost a joke in the field. If you talk to a reporter and you say there's heritable influence on something, the first thing they say is that the headline will be the gene for.
Yeah.
And thinking if it's genetic, it's a single gene. Now, single gene mutations are single genes. I mean, you know, there's maybe people say 7,000, 10,000 is a huge number of single gene disorders. Most of them are extremely rare because natural selection gets rid of them if they have negative effects on reproduction. But, you know, the one people may have heard about is, God, I'm blocking on it, chromosome 4.
Huntington's?
Huntington's disease, right, with Woody Guthrie, who died that. And if you were Arlo Guthrie, his son, you'd have a 50% chance of having that mutation, a single gene mutation on the tip of chromosome 4 that would determine that you get Huntington's, unless something else killed you first. It doesn't matter what your exercise regime is, what you eat or anything. It is hardwired and deterministic. And that's what Mendel studied, 7 single gene mutations in the pea plant. And the problem is that's how we learn about genetics. And so if you say genetic, people are thinking single genes, black or white, you've either got it or you don't have it. And that's the way each gene works. But what I tried to say before is that it's a completely different story when you go to complex traits and common disorders, like all medical disorders. they're influenced by thousands of genes of little effect, which makes them move from a hardwired determinism to a probabilistic propensity. And so it's hard enough for people to understand risk at a single gene level, you know, like if a couple both have they're carriers for recessive disorder, what proportion of their offspring will have the disorder? 25%. What percentage will be carriers? 50%. So it's even harder at a single gene level. But then when you get into really probabilistic influences, you know, like 50% heritable, and I can predict, say, half of the variants, half of those differences with inherited DNA, it is hard for people to get it. But it is like all other risk factors. I mean, you know, if you think about smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day, what are your chances of getting lung cancer? It actually isn't that high, because so many other things can kill you. It's just that most of the people who die of lung cancer have smoked a lot. But there's a lot of people who smoke a lot who don't get lung cancer. So it's actually quite surprising to look at things that have completely changed our lives and then ask, well, how strong an effect is that? And very often you find it's not a strong effect. And in fact, I think the genetics is getting up there in terms of powerful predictions. But I guess the point I wanted to make, I'll come back to, is this: the idea of variance. We're talking about differences between people. And so the first mistake people make is, you say genetic, they think single gene, they think determinism. But we're talking about polygenic propensities, likelihoods, risks, not black or white, do you have it or not? But the other thing I find is, people cannot get their head around the fact that we're talking about differences between people in the population. Why are some people heavy, some people thin? Why do some people get schizophrenia and others not? And that's what I say when I talk about variance. And so you say weight is 60% heritable. And people say, you know, they always can't help but think this way. Okay, 60% of my weight is due to genes, and the other 40% is due to the environment. And that's completely wrong. It's what we're saying is, of the differences between people in the population, 60% of those differences are due to inherited DNA differences. And it's not the same thing, because there could be some people for whom it's all genetic, some people for whom it's all environmental. But we're saying, on average, in the population, genetics is accounting for 60% of the differences between people. So I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something that is hard for people to understand. And so heritability is a six-syllable word that's probably the most misunderstood word in biology. It refers to the amount of variance that is explained by inherited DNA differences. I'll just emphasize that we're talking about differences between people, not about one individual, not about you, but about us.
Yeah, fair. And just to clarify that in a little bit more detail before we go on to some other subjects I want to talk about, with maybe we can stay on weight specifically, the 60% being influenced by what at a population level, inheritance, genetic inheritance, the 40%. And again, I think this is something that people have a hard time. I know we talked about this a little bit earlier in the conversation, but that 40%, you know, I'd love to give you a little bit more space to dig into what that 40% is really indicating. And I know you, I believe, have a view that a lot of that is just about randomness. Again, correct me if I'm wrong about that, but I'd love to give you just a little bit more time to clarify that, right? That 40% that is the nurture component here.
Right. Well, it's something that interests me a lot right now. And it's actually, randomness is a very hot topic in all of science, going from quantum mechanics to cosmology and biology. And what I think is cool, there's a famous paper by Eagle, a philosopher of science, in 2005 called Randomness is Unpredictability. So randomness means a lot of different things to people. But what we mean is, it's you can't predict it. And that's a nice operational definition. So we're talking about things that we can't predict. And so one way to think about it is, you know, you start life as this single cell and the same DNA in all of our cells. And I think it's sort of remarkable that that genetic message can feed through our development from a cell to an embryo to a baby to an adolescent to an adult and still have an effect. I think it's amazing that it can actually shine all the way through that complexity. But it is an incredibly complex system. And so I think it seems almost certain that there's bound to be a lot of noise in that system. I mean, it, evolution and DNA have done the best it can to be true to it, the parents, basically to its heredity. But that's a pretty damn good job, you know, explaining 50% of the variance between people, given all the environmental stuff we're bombarded with, for example. So people talk about the endogenous systems, you know, and the idea of biological complexity. And there's quite a bit of biological work on this, using organisms that are cloned, and you can have them in in exactly the same. There's an Amazon Molly where you can, I won't go into the details, but there's some very neat experiments where you can show that it is random. I mean, there's nothing that happened environmentally, and yet you get differences even in behavior in these organisms with exactly, they're cloned, exactly the same DNA and exactly the same environment, each raised in a, well, fish tank, that's exactly. So it's really quite impressive stuff. But what I'm more interested in is also at a psychological level. You know, that a lot of your podcasts and a lot of what everybody talks about is what I would call normative. You know, we talk about humans. You do this and this will happen. But actually, the message of genetics is we're all really, we are unique individuals. And so I think even at a psychological level, there's got to be a lot of noise. And that's, so I'm interested not just in the endogenous biological noise, which we know to be true, but also at a psychological level. And these are real experiences. They're just not these systematic experiences that we're used to thinking about. And so in a way, the messages that the message from the genetic and environmental research here that kind of fits with a lot of your podcast is that actually, as you started out by saying, DNA is the major systematic force making us who we are as individuals. And the rest, randomness is an important part of life. And I think it's good for us to think about that and to realize maybe we have less control than we think. You know, it gets into the free will issue, but and I wouldn't even necessarily disagree with Sapolsky's new, you know, book, Determined, because in a way that seems to me, yeah, you could go back and say, okay, I'm raising my finger here. I can trace everything back that led to that, but can I predict, knowing all of that? And, you know, even if you knew, as I say, all the atoms and everything about it, could you predict this, you know? And I don't know. So a lot of that is going backwards, and everything is determined, certainly, you know, it's all, we know a lot about the neurology of that. And so I don't disagree with that. It's just, for me, it's the question of predictability. And I think that is, at least from my point of view, it looks pretty random to me. And that's a major change in the way we think about the environment.
I don't know if this fits into that, the randomness component that you're talking about, but one of my best friends for many years is an identical twin. And no one who meets him and meets his brother who knows them has any difficulty knowing who is who. They're different in temperament. They're different in personality. I remember one of the things I wrote down from listening to some of your interviews is that, again, correct me where I'm wrong in any of this, but something like identical twins where one of the children, one of the adults is gay, the probability that the other person is gay is only 60%, which again, to I think a fully deterministic outlook seems impossible or at least highly unlikely. And I don't know how you'd like to respond to those examples, but does that in some way get to the randomness that you're speaking about?
Yeah, well, if a trait were 100% heritable, you would expect that identical twins would be identical.
Mm.
Nothing is 100% heritable. So that 40% is actually, you know, pretty close to the twin and adoption estimates of heritability of sexual preference of 40%, say. So what's interesting is you take for identical twins reared apart, they're just as similar as identical twins reared together. So being reared together doesn't make you any more similar. And one thing I find that helps people understand how you put these things together, genetics and sort of random environments, is that putting these two things together, I would say that if there had been a mistake when you were born and in the maternity room, the wrong parents took you home. So you're raised in a different family, different school, different environment, different friends. I would predict you'd be just as similar. You'd be just as similar to who you are now as if it were your identical twin. You know, that the genetics would come through, and being reared in a different family wouldn't make much difference. You would be much the same person that you are now at the genetics, but it's only the genetics that's making that prediction. And it's interesting for personality. There's some evidence that identical twins reared apart are more similar than identical twins reared together. And that may be the case of this identical twin pair, you know, where some of them, you know, it's pretty weird having someone who looks just like you. Now, in childhood, you can, if you have 1% of all births are twins, so everybody knows some twins. And early in life, people would say, oh, you can't tell them apart. You know, as you grow up, you can, because, you know, they wear different clothes and dye their hair differently or something like that. But with one question, you can, what we call diagnose zygosity. You can say whether the pair is identical or paternal. Well, if they're one half of all fraternal twins, these are like siblings born together, 50% similar genetically, one half are opposite sex. So without knowing a lot about genetics, you could say, well, those guys aren't identical twins. Mm. But of the same sex twins, with one question, you can find out, you can be about 95% accurate if they're identical twins or not. And that is, when they were growing up, did people have trouble telling them apart? Because that question summarizes a lot of physical characteristics and even personality characteristics. So identical twins are amazingly similar. You rarely can find identical twins who differ by more than an inch in height, for example. So it's the genetics that makes them similar. But the environment, even if they grow up together, makes them different. And so, you know, personality is less heritable. So you said these identical twins, you know, they differ a lot in personality. I bet you they don't differ a lot.
Yeah, not much, but yes, exactly.
Height, hair color, that sort of thing. And those are very highly heritable characteristics. So I do think identical twins that's something that everybody kind of sees, and it is a remarkable demonstration of the importance of genetics, even though we tend to focus on telling them apart and saying, oh, that one's different. Because I do this large twin study of about 15,000 pairs of twins in England, 25 years ago when I came to England, they've now grown up, and many of them end up taking classes with me just because they've become interested in genetics. And one of them, it was my PhD student until recently, when she finished. And you ask her about her and her identical twin sister. And she, oh, no, we're very different. And what's her sister doing? She's doing a PhD in anthropology. But, you know, that's very different. You know,
right.
She's this one studying genetics, you know. So some identical twins feel they have to push the differences to kind of forge their own identity. But others kind of, you know, relish it, and it makes them special. And, you know, it's kind of cool, like fooling their boyfriends as to which is which and that sort of thing.
I want to read a couple quotes from your book and then ask you a question. about this subject. And the first one is, I've heard you say this a bunch, everything is heritable, nothing is 100% heritable. The second is, parents matter, but they don't make a difference. And I guess maybe I'll sneak in a third, which is that I think I heard you say this in a podcast, that all parents are environmentalists, meaning that they're nurturists. They're convinced initially that it's all about nurture. And the quote is, parents are environmentalists until they have more than one kid. And
well, great. Those are three really key questions. And it's kind of nice to tie this stuff together. The first point is, when I was in graduate school in the 1970s, if you looked at psychology textbooks at the time, I was in graduate school in psychology, they would tell you it was completely environmentalistic. Everything was due to the environment, and especially parenting. As I mentioned, Freud and schizophrenia and psychopathology, it's all due to the way your mother treated you in the first few years of life. So over the decades then, into the 80s and 90s, more and more of this behavioral genetic data piled up, twin and adoption studies, creating a mountain of evidence, as well as animal studies, which are even more powerful, but creating a mountain of evidence for the importance of genetics. So psychology went in 30 years from being totally environmentalistic to having a much more balanced view, where most psychologists, it's hard to find any now that would deny the importance of genetics. And more than that now, when I started in the 1970s, you had to be careful talking about anything in psychology being heritable. But now the challenge is to find anything in psychology reliably measured that does not show significant and substantial genetic influence. And you're finding 50% heritability for behavioral traits contrasts with findings in psychology that rarely explain more than 1 or 2% of the variance. 5% is sort of off the scale. If you can find anything in psychology that explains some psychological trait, 5% of the variance, that's called the effect size, that's amazing. But this isn't 5%. This is 50%. And so that's the first point, that we've gone from thinking nothing's heritable to realizing that everything is heritable. In fact, I find myself more often now saying, but nothing is 100% heritable. Mm. You know, I got to add that as well. And so the second thing you raised was this thing in my book. It's only like 7 pages in the book, but it was a section on parenting. And so I used the phrase, parents matter, but they don't make a difference. And I hope, given our discussion, people kind of get an idea of what I mean there. Parents certainly matter. I mean, the human species has evolved to be monogamous. We can't survive on their own. You know, you need a caretaker. So parents are important. And more than that, you know, they provide the emotional support for kids and all of that. So parents they do matter. But they don't make a difference in the sense of individual differences. So their parenting doesn't have an effect on whether their children become schizophrenic later in life. And so, you know, it's heartrending to get these letters from people saying, you know, everything was going fine until adolescence, and then the kid went off the rail. And these are obviously parents that have done everything for their kids. So if you think it's all environmental, that's pretty tough when things go badly. And in fact, it's not your fault. You really have much less control over your children's outcome environmentally. And so that brings us to that third point you make, that parents are environmentalists until they have more than one kid. I don't think that's probably as true as it used to be. I know I did my graduate work in Boulder in the 70s, and that was Time magazine had a cover story saying, "Where the hip come to trip." It was a very post-60s sort of place, lots of drugs and hippies and, you know. And I found a number of women who didn't want a man around, but they wanted to have a kid. And they actually would just say, they'd go into a bar, one night stand, get pregnant. And as a geneticist, I was horrified, you know, saying, you know, that's a big mistake. I mean, you know, if you're going to do that, why not do it a little bit more intelligently? But that would require recognizing genetics is important. And they firmly believe, without thinking about it, but just assumed it's all TLC, tender loving care, not DNA. They never even think about DNA. But when you become a parent, you have one kid, you can still be an environmentalist because you can explain away everything environmentally. Now, that sounds like a good thing for a theory, but it's actually a bad thing. If a theory explains everything, it explains nothing. So here's a good one with young parents. You ask them, if you get a kid who, if they're in the middle, it doesn't help. But if you have a kid who's shy, particularly shy, for example, and you ask parents, why do you think your daughter's shy? And they invariably give you one of two answers. I took her out too much when she was young, or I didn't take her out enough when she was young. Now, therein lies the problem with environmental explanations, you know, post hoc. But then they have a second kid, and the second kid is only 50% similar to the first kid. So if the first kid is very shy, and shyness is one of the more heritable aspects of personality in infancy, then you could predict that this second child is not going to be so shy. And when parents see that, they say, I didn't do that. Because, you know, if we took the kids out a lot, when they, you know, so they begin to realize they didn't do that. And a terrific novelists are often much better at presenting this stuff than scientists. And I don't know if people know Karl Ove Nosgaard, the famous author who wrote the, 7,000 page, I think it is 7,000 page series of, six volumes about sort of his life. It's like Proust at a psychological level, where he actually spends, I think, 40, 50 pages describing his four-year-old daughter's birthday party and each of the people around. But it's like Proust. It's so brilliant, you know, at explaining things. But he had three kids. He had done graduate work in sociology. So he's totally an environmentalist. And his description of this first kid, you know, environmental, you could sort of see his mother was a little, you know, whatever. And then, but then the second kid, and then the third kid. And by chance, he had three kids as different as any three kids, temperamentally, you know, sports, you name it. And so that's when he really came around to the idea that he might have been an environmentalist, but once he had more than one child, he began to appreciate the importance of genetics. And that's an important message for parents, because if they think their kids are a blob of clay they can mold to be whatever they want them to be, they're in for a world of hurt. It's much better to say, what you want to do is find out what your kid likes to do, what they're good at, and you help them do that. Not because you want to make them into something you want them to be, but because you want them to be happy. You love them. You want to make life as nice as you can for them. So I think it's a different way of thinking about parenting. And I'm sure, you know, it would help a lot of parents. And I find, especially in my age, we talked about yuppie parents who prolong childhood birth of children until much later in life. And then they've got their precious one child, and parenting books and magazines prey on the anxieties of young parents. If you don't do this, your child's going to be ruined forever. So I think it's very important for parents to realize they matter. They make day-to-day life, you know, nice for kids because they love them, but they don't make a difference in the long run. So why not enjoy watching your child become who they are genetically, rather than mistakenly thinking that you're going to make them be what you want them to be.
This is a perfect segue into a quote. This is way before I knew we were going to talk, but I wrote this quote down after seeing a documentary at the Tribeca Film Festival of a collection of comedians reflecting on their life. I've been a longtime stand-up comedy fan, and there was a comedian in the documentary who is quite famous, and I had never heard of her before, who had really come up against her parents' expectations of who they wanted her to be. And she was reflecting on a comment her father-in-law made at her biological mother's funeral about how they had treated her. And I wanted to read that to you. And it's this, it's from a comedian named Tig Notaro. She said, quote, this is coming from her stepfather. It is not the child's responsibility to teach the parent who they are. it's the parent's responsibility to learn who their child is. And I think that's essentially what you just said, that
exactly.
you want to help them be who they are, to encourage their nature as they come out. I'd love for you to give any additional feedback you may have on that.
Right. Well, no, I think that's exactly right. That hit it right on the head. But it doesn't mean parents can't do anything. It's the same issue. It's not determined. It's just that, for example, you want your child to be happy, but if they're going around being aggressive, hitting other kids on the head, you don't say, oh, well, that's just who they are. You know, you control that behavior because it's not good for them. You know, it's not going to make them happy. Now, you have limited control in the long run. If you had a child who is just very angry, prone or aggressive or whatever, maybe later in life they're going to be that way. But at least while you have control over them, you don't want them hitting other kids on the head. And you know, schools have been very successful in, say, controlling bullying. But, you know, by just having zero tolerance for bullying at school. That doesn't mean, though, when the bullies go outside of school and school no longer has control, they might still be bullies. But at least in this situation, you've controlled that behavior. And so I don't want people to have the idea that I'm just saying, well, parents can't do anything. It's the same idea. You know, it doesn't mean you can't do anything. In fact, if you want your kid to be an Olympic athlete, you can, you know, if that's your whole goal and you put all your energy into it, you could make your kid a much faster runner. You could get coaches and all of that. But if they don't have the genetic goods, they're just not going to ever be an elite athlete. Hmm. And in fact, by pushing your agenda, it's probably counterproductive to your relationship with the child, because you're telling them you love them because they're going to be an Olympic athlete. You know, and it's a losing proposition. So you might as well just say, you know, you love them regardless. You know, kind of Carl Rogers, unconditional love, and you'll support them as best you can. And you do things for them because you love them, not because you want to make them into something.
Mm. To me, this is part of the compassionate lens that all of your work and the work of your field is giving to humanity about why people are the way they are, and that, you know, we're both Americans. I know you live in England, but there is this, you know, ever more zeitgeist in the culture here about how you can be anything you want to be. And to a certain degree, I love that message of encouraging people to get the most out of themselves. But at a certain point, it is cruel to give people who are not, like you just said, I mean, sports has always been I think a less controversial field, because it's obvious from an early age that some people are more gifted in soccer than others. And to tell a mediocre 8-year-old soccer player that they can play for Arsenal just seems not only crazy, but also mean.
Exactly right. Yeah, people don't really seem to think, you know, it sounds like, who could disagree? You could be anything you want to be. You know, sounds right, you know, good, improve yourself. But, you know, the downside of that is if you set your goal on being an Olympic athlete or an elite athlete, what is that? 1% of 1% of the people get there. So does that mean that you didn't try hard enough?
Mm.
So I think it's far better to recognize there are individual differences in everything. And we should get away from being pejorative about what's good and what's bad. It's just people. And we all have strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, we do need to be more compassionate about it and to recognize that, you know, as we started out by saying, fat people aren't fat people just because they're lazy slobs and they can't control themselves. You know, it's just they have genetic risks that other people don't have. And so I do think compassion for other people, sort of for our children too, you know, that was sort of the message there. And then we haven't really talked about for understanding ourselves as well. You know, we need to be more compassionate and to recognize there are these differences, not that you can't do anything about it, but to recognize that it's harder for me to keep my weight down and to lose weight than it is for other people. Doesn't mean I don't do it, But I recognize that, okay, I'm never going to be skinny, but, you know, I'm doing a pretty good job at keeping myself at the 75th percentile of weight, even though genetically I'm at the 95th percentile.
Yeah. And I know I just realized we're over time and I could talk to you for many more hours, but maybe we can close on, and I would love to do this again if we can find some time at some point in the future, because this stuff just is endlessly fascinating to me. About 10 years ago, I've always been an interview nerd. And my favorite interview from the Charlie Rose Show was one that he did with E.O. Wilson and James Watson. And James Watson was remarking, it's the first time the ideas that we talked about today really got put into my head. He was remarking about how he gave the example of Polynesians, about how part of the issue that he has seen in Polynesian cultures is obesity. And a large reason for that is because historically they were, you know, quote unquote, designed to take long boat rides in between their islands, and they had to put on calories very quickly to be able to live in that environment. And it was the first time I think I had ever come across the idea that nature, it's obvious once you think about it, that nature has, you know, adapted people to their environment more or less, and that you should expect that there would be differences in people around the world in all sorts of different ways. And one of the quotes I remember from that conversation was that, this may have been E.O. Wilson who said, you know, something like the 20th century was about reconciling evolution and biology, and the 21st century will be about reconciling evolution and the mind and psychology. Yes. And that isn't just an endless, I've done so many shows about this, and I'm sure I'll do many more, but maybe this is a good subject just to close on, because I know, as I said, we could talk about this for a long time, but what are we learning about how much genes play a role in, I think a lot of people can accept that, yes, they influence your height, they influence and influence perhaps how you physically look, but your mind is also influenced enormously by your genes, and whether that be your temperament, your predisposition to psychopathology, which is something you've alluded to. I'd love to just give that to you and have you speak at whatever length you'd like about what we're learning about how important genes really are in affecting the minds of individual human beings, and maybe more importantly, what people might be able to do about that once they begin to have this, the knowledge that they can get from some of these tests, and also just having this perspective on the role that genes are probably playing in forming their own psychology.
Yeah, well, there's so much in that question. It's really great. Let me start, though, just with the Polynesian example, something I'd like to mention, that it might be, you know, the idea that they had to be adapted to put on weight quickly to be able to survive these long voyages. But, you know, even more than that, you know, it has been thought, I don't know how well documented this is now, it used to be the idea that we evolved in a Stone Age in which you didn't know when the next meal was coming. So it was actually very adaptive to have genes that put on weight, because you store that food. You can, you know, get a dead animal now and you eat and you gorge yourself, you put on weight, and that fat is storage so that you don't know when your next meal is coming along. So actually those might have been adaptive sort of genes to have you put on weight in a Stone Age environment, but in a fast food world, it's disadvantageous, those same genes. So I think tying together the genetics with evolution is very, it's a big issue. And with the DNA revolution, it has to work, you know, and ancient DNA and Neanderthals, there's, you know, always new information coming out there about where we came from, because, you know, on average have 2% of genes from Neanderthals, for example. So, you know, I think that's going to be a really neat area to tie modern molecular genetics into ancient DNA and our predecessors, not necessarily tens of thousands of years ago, but maybe just, you know, a few thousand years ago or 1,000 years ago. And there's so much, you know, people do DNA testing for three reasons, and mostly they do ancestry.com, which tells you about this. And, you know, it's so fascinating that you know, you think you're whatever mix of European and whatever population, and you often find, you know, your history is actually quite different from what you thought. And we're all mongrels is the main message you get. You know, you're not pure Irish or pure anything. So I think that is the first reason people do it. And the second is they want to find out about single gene disorders, and that you can do very well. And because, you know, any of these SNP chips, they're very accurate and efficient, and they're easy to interpret. You know, you either have this allele or that allele or two of these recessive alleles. And on that score, I mean, something people should think about, I assume your audience is young by and large, and there's a movement afoot to offer whole genome sequencing to couples who are planning to get married. Because almost all of the genetic disorders, single gene disorders, are recessive. And people don't find out about them until they have a kid who's affected. But if you did the whole genome sequencing, you could say, you know, the chances are probably maybe less than 10%, probably less than 5%. We all carry some of these lethal single gene recessive disorders, but we're carriers. We only have one copy. So we don't show it. That's how it survives in natural selection. You're picking a partner, and maybe she, you know, she has the same probability, but what's the probability that you both have that same mutation? And you're both carriers for that trait. If you found out that were the case, you know, you could decide ahead of time then what you want to do. But we could actually eliminate these single gene recessive disorders in one generation, which apparently costs, you know, these estimates are crazy, but they say it's $1 trillion a year. You know, it's all, and these are bad things. You know, these are, you know, kids dying early and that sort of thing. So that's the second reason, finding out about single genes. And the third reason is people are catching on to the idea of polygenic scores. But unfortunately, most of these companies don't really provide good information for that. But what you can do is 23andMe will allow you to push a button to download your genotypes from the SNP chip. And there are other companies that allow you to upload it, and they give you polygenic scores. The problem being, right now, they're not very good. And it's a scandal. There's no regulation in this whole industry. And so they want your DNA. Big data is what it's all about. And why they don't, for the same amount of effort, they could give you good polygenic scores, and they could give you the information to interpret it. They don't. But there is a new company that just started earlier this year called Nucleus Genomics, out of New York, and you can only do it in the U.S. right now. But they provide top-notch information, and they actually specialize in whole genome sequencing, so that it's still more expensive. It's like $600 or something. But once you've done whole genome sequencing, that's it. And so forevermore then, you know, that's your information that you could then get polygenic scores for any sort of medical risks. So what I like especially about them is that they're providing useful interpretation. Like if I'm at the 95th percentile for some medical risk, well, you need to know more than that, because what if that polygenic score only explains 1% of the variance? Well, I'm high, but for something that isn't very predictive. And so you need to provide that contextual information to make sense out of what this means. And I think they do a very good job at that. So this will happen. And it's, you know, just, it's all new. So right now it's caveat emptor, you know, you got to buyer beware with a lot of these commercial companies. But the big ones, 23andMe and Ancestry.com, they give you very good genotypic information. And so Ancestry gives you very good information about your ethnicity. 23andMe gives you good information about several hundred single gene mutations. Also, a lot of stupid little things like, can you curl your tongue? And do you, when you eat asparagus, does your pee smell? You know, stuff like that, which makes it kind of gimmicky in a way. But The single gene mutations, when most people, because these are very rare, they'll tell me, well, yeah, they did it, but they don't have any of these mutations. You know, as if, well, that was a gyp, but they don't recognize it. That's very, very good news, you know, that you don't have any of these things. So it's happening and it will happen. And I wrote the book, Blueprint, because I just wanted to give people the literacy about DNA to be able to think about these issues. I won't say there aren't possible problems. There definitely are problems. There's lots of people who talk about the problems, but I'd rather be a cheerleader because I can see a lot of good coming out of this. And no matter how you feel about it, it's really happening in the medical arena. And I have no doubt that psychology and psychiatry will get on the train as well.
Yeah. To add one additional quick question, I'm sure you've thought a lot about this, Robert. Like, how should our society change because of the, you know, truths of a lot of this subject, you know, to make it a better, more compassionate, more enlightened society? And you must think a lot about this, but I'd love to just close by putting that to you. In your mind, how can this information and this new cutting-edge science help humanity make a better place to live, a more compassionate place to live for people?
Well, I don't think that's going to be at the technical level of, you know, polygenic scores and everything. It's more at this conceptual level of recognizing that inherited DNA differences count for a lot of differences among people. So it's not to deny free will or to say people aren't responsible for what they do. It's not deterministic, but it is probabilistic. And it's important to know, you know, like the example with weight that we've come back to several times, that you do need to recognize that if you're thin, it's not virtuous particularly. You know, you probably just, you know, don't have the genetic propensity to get fat. And those of us on the other side of the distribution do need a little bit more compassion and, you know, definitely not fat shaming. That isn't going to help anybody. So I think it's only at that larger conceptual level. And, you know, it's partly why I like to talk about this stuff. And, you know, as you said, especially also in relation to parenting and their kids. And then, as I mentioned earlier, compassion towards ourselves as well. Part of understanding who you are is to recognize your genetic propensities. And B.F. Skinner, the famous learning psychologist, had this great quote. He was the ultimate environmentalist. He raised his daughter in a cage, basically, so he could control her environment. She was quite screwed up as a result of that, as you might think. But later in life, he wrote a book on old age, and in it, he said something very wise. He said, "The older I get, the more I become who I am."
Hmm.
You have younger listeners, presumably, but I think it's something to really think about. You know, as you get older, you kind of say, screw it, that's the way I am. I mean, you know, if I'm a shy person, I don't like going to cocktail parties where I don't know a lot of people. And, you know, people who are very sociable and not shy, they say, are you crazy? I mean, there must be something wrong with you, because for them, that's the ideal thing to do, is to go to a cocktail party where they don't know people. For people like me who are shyer, that is hell. I don't like that at all. So, I think it has ramifications, not just for compassion towards other people or understanding our kids better, but really understanding ourselves. And part of that is knowing that DNA is the major systematic cause of who we are as individuals.
Mm. That example with Skinner is, I think, a good one, because my understanding has been that parents don't play that large of a difference, that large of a role in who their kids become, absent neglect, absent abuse. I don't know if that's your conclusion from that example, but is that fair to conclude with?
Absolutely right. You know, one of those caveats I started out with about heritability, you know, I talked about some, we're talking about individual differences in a population, and we're describing what is in a particular population. We're not saying what could be if the environment or the genetics change. And the other caveat I decided not to mention at that time is the one you're raising. We're talking about the normal range of variation that we can study at the extremes of genetics and environment. You know, we're not talking about a trait that is only 40% of a 60% heritable, like obesity. There are single gene mutations that cause people to be obese in a hardwired way. But also on the other side, as you point out, neglect and abuse can have a big effect. That's what could be rather than what is in the populations that we can describe. But to make the point, you know, more dramatically, that we're studying what is rather than what could be. Despite my genetic propensity to weight, you lock me in a room without food, I lose weight. And so that's not nothing, but that's not what we're talking about here. It's why people out there with the mix of genetics and environment that we see in our society, why, what causes those differences in body mass index? And the answer is genetics accounts for the majority of those differences.
Yeah. Amazing.
Right. Well, Dan, you were saying about talking again, and maybe if you find you get audience reaction and they come up with questions, I'd be happy to meet with you again. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Same, Robert. This was such an honor. And thank you again so much for doing this. I would love to do that at some point in the future.
Great.
Take care, man.
Bye.